Here is what you need to know about today. President Trump joins his European counterparts in Geneva, and it doesn't go so well. Speaking of Geneva, look at the welcome that these G7 guys got. I got to tell you something else. Yeah. There has been another drone attack on Russian civilians. This one may be really cruel. Just happened, but what are the G7 guys that I just showed you? What are the EU guys complaining about? They're talking about an errant drone in Romania while ignoring this one. The double standard is absolutely amazing. I'm going to show it to you right here on the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. Millions of you are connecting with us, and we certainly appreciate the fact that you are there for us every day. There is a new name for the riots that frequently occur in Western countries. What do you say we call it from now on? Epstein riots. Because isn't that really what they are? Case in point, what happened this weekend in Geneva? Here, let's take a look at some of the pictures together. Thousand people came together to protest the meeting of the G7. While their actions, look, nobody's for setting fires and breaking stuff. It's not something that should be condoned. But this is important. Let me say this to you. It's important to understand that these people protesting are protesting a group of people and a group of organizations and countries who do things much worse than this. These protesters may be disrupting a city for a couple of days and burning some crap and destroying a couple of things, which they probably shouldn't do. But the countries that they're protesting, that make up the G7, they assassinate, they infiltrate, they bankrupt, they kill, they steal resources, they foment coups, and they start wars. Wars that benefit really a small number of people. And those people who benefit from the wars in the process become billionaires, who then pump their assets, their money, back into the hands of these G7 countries. So these protesters, they may have a point. By the way, what is the G7? Well, the protesters describe it in interviews with Reuters this way. They say the G7 is a symbol of concentrated political and economic power used against everyday citizens. Not a bad description. I mean, not for nothing, but I think they got a point. After all, the people who attend the G7, they're all either billionaires themselves, untouchable billionaires, even when there's evidence that they've raped young girls, i.e. Epstein class, or they're compensated by billionaires who are part of the Epstein class, a group that, by the way, gets richer and richer and richer with each passing G7 meeting. Ask yourself this question. Should 7 countries have that much power and essentially run the world? I mean, we're talking about 7 countries that make up less than 10% of the world's population, but they control 50% of the world's wealth. They use up more than 25% of the world's resources and energy. But again, they're like 9.83% of the world's population. So the answer is obviously no, they shouldn't. That's not fair. Take a look at these guys. Let's see what they look. There they are. There's the G7, right? With some invited guests. There's Mr. Trump pulling a Biden, drifting off in the wrong direction. He doesn't seem to know where he is. So Francis Macron pretending, by the way, he can't stand Trump, going over, pretending to be his friend to rescue him. Then look at Mr. Trump. Now he's sauntering off as the rest of the G7 crew and special invitees try and figure out how to look important. It's kind of embarrassing to see these guys. I don't know. It is to me. Who are these people? You know who else the rest of the world is looking at? Because there's a group of countries who are looking at these guys and saying, wait a minute, the big boys like China, Russia, Iran, they're waking up and they're figuring out that maybe even it's time to pass up the G7 crowd when it comes to things like GDP growth and energy production, even standing armies and weapons production. Those countries that I just named have passed the G7 countries. In fact, when you compare, just pick out 6. We'll leave out the United States. Let's pick out 6 of the G7 countries: Canada, Japan, France, UK, Germany, Italy, and put them next to Russia and China and India and Iran and even South Africa. Put them side by side. Those countries look puny. Italy? Give me a break. And by the way, even people in the G7 are starting to realize this. Even G7 leaders themselves are starting to realize, hey, what are we doing here, right? Here's the Prime Minister of Canada. Listen to what he just said during this meeting yesterday.
And it's a recognition that the G7, if it ever did run the world, no longer runs the world or pretends to.
No longer runs the world. Yes, they did run the world, okay? And many would argue they still kind of do, from a hegemony standpoint. So there seems to be a recognition, though, that they no longer run the world. That's creeping in, right? Now, does that mean they're going to stop trying to run the world? Hell no. Look at what they do in Russia. I mean, because with the possible exception of China, there's no country in the world whose power and presence and size and resources just bothers the crap or intimidates the G7 Epstein class more than Russia. Russia is the one country that's like, yeah, we hate Russia, right? It's obvious. It's what NATO's all about, breaking up, destroying Russia. And by the way, the funny thing is, Russia, since 1991, has bent over backward to try and join that club. And all they've ever gotten is kicked in the teeth. In fact, it's worse. Russia's constantly under attack. And I don't mean just verbal attacks. I mean attacks like bombings, terrorism, assassinations, drones, you name it. Look at this. This morning I was thinking about this, so I Googled it, right? And I put it in a little bit of ChatGPT and just I asked it, in the last 3 years, how many attacks have there been on Russia? Here it is. I'm scrolling it for you because if I was to try and read all this to you, we'd be here all day, or at least for quite some time. So look at this. Going back to 2023, you see attacks on apartment buildings, Moscow attacks, attacks on bridges, killing of civilians, 20 people hit on a beach, a railway station blown up. Now, some of these could be considered military targets, but the vast majority are not. A drone attack on a bakery kills 28 people. 149 people killed at the Crocus Concert Hall. More people attacked in Moscow by drone attacks. More civilians killed. Drones hit Moscow airport. A school dormitory, right? Kills what, 21? Commuter bus attack. This is just 2 weeks ago. Drone attack kills a family of three, including a baby in Tula. This thing just goes on and on and on. The list is exhaustive. It's like 53 items on here. Most people around the world don't even know anything about this. They don't. They have no idea this is happening because it's generally not reported by the West. Think about that. Russia, the country with the most nuclear warheads on the planet, is constantly being attacked by weapons, guidance systems, by and with the blessing of those little G7 countries I just showed you. And the media in those countries, they don't even report it or they minimize it. But look what happens when a Russian drone accidentally goes into Romanian airspace. This just happened in the last 3 or 4 days. That story, oh, big time, man. It's like their hair is on fire. Look at this headline. And this is The Guardian, by the way. NATO ready to defend every inch of territory as Russian drone hits Romania. Moscow's reckless behavior is danger after drone hits apartment building while Russia denies involvement. It's like, you can't make this stuff up. More than 700 Russian civilians have been killed by drone strikes and other assorted attacks. Barely gets a mention. One errant drone from the fighting in Ukraine goes off course, lands in Romania. You'd think the sky is falling. World War III on the brink. You know, it's important to note this because when you think about it, look, it's not even still confirmed if that drone was Ukrainian or Russian. But even if it was Russian, right? As for the damage, I looked it up. It was relatively minor. So were the injuries. The Guardian makes it sound like it's the most serious thing in the world. But I did a little digging, and what I found out was there were two injuries. Both were minor injuries, like grease burns. like small kitchen burns you get from holding a saucer pan or something for too long. To hear the G7 types, it was a horrible attack perpetrated by Russia. Remember, these are the same people who've been attacking Russian civilians for the past 3 years. I'm not saying either side is right when civilians are hurt, but can you have some sense of fairness? I mean, I'll give you examples of some of the things, because the sky is falling is an understatement. Here's Mark Rutte. He's the head of NATO. Listen to what he says.
Russia's reckless behavior is a danger to us all. They continue to target civilians and civilian infrastructure across Ukraine, and last night showed yet again that the implications of their illegal war of aggression don't stop at the border.
You can always count on Rutte to blow everything up, right? Here's Romania's foreign minister vying to impress Europe's elites in what is an obvious bid for EU funding. Take a listen.
We will officially communicate the consequences that this lack of responsibility on the part of the Russian Federation will have for the diplomatic relations between our countries, as well as the next steps at the European level regarding sanctions packages.
And obviously, we can't leave out Ursula von der Leyen. She wakes up every morning thinking, Russia, Russia, Russia. What can I say about Russia that's bad? Here she is.
Russia's war of aggression has crossed yet another line. A Russian drone incursion struck a densely populated area in Romania, injuring civilians on EU territory. We stand in full solidarity with Romania and its people.
But it's almost providence what happened late this afternoon, because there's more. I want to share with you something now that really just happened today, something that is both sad and ironic. I wrote this script and prepared this newscast for you before I knew about this, because this information has literally just come in. In other words, what I'm about to share with you is like brand new information. Yes, just in the last couple of hours, a bus carrying a soccer team from Belarus to Russia, there it is, to play in a tournament in Russia, was hit by a Ukrainian drone. This is a bus going from Belarus to Russia. Had nothing to do with Ukraine. And these are the images that we've gotten so far. There were like 44 people on the bus. I guess they described it as a double-decker of some kind. 28 of them were children. One woman was killed instantly by the blast from the drone where she was sitting, unfortunately. For her, six more people have been taken to the hospital. I mean, that's amazing. And I want to show you where this happened. I want you to make sure you have a good sense of where exactly this happened. I'm going to go up here and see if I can put it on the map. Okay, there it is. See that? That's it. That's Bryansk. This is the oblast. It's a region of Russia that butts up. This here is Belarus. This here is Russia. And this here is Ukraine. So can you tell me why somebody here, no less a school bus with children on board who were going to play a soccer tournament in Russia, would be hit by a drone? I mean, anywhere in the world, this would be called an act of terrorism. But if it happens in Russia, it's not an act of terrorism. It's just whatever, right? And it's not even covered. I mean, you almost have to ask yourself, wow, where's the outrage here? So, by the way, I've looked at this. I looked at it for you a little bit. And so far, hardly even a mention. I immediately went to see, you know, what's CNN reporting? What's the BBC reporting? Nada. Niet. Right? Not a thing. So you see what I mean? I mean, it's ridiculous sometimes. When Russian civilians are attacked, nothing. The Epstein class has been trying to break up, destroy, and weaken Russia for almost 80 years now. And they're still attacking it to this day. And when they do, and I'm not saying Russia's blameless, but report the stuff when it happens. But it's crickets. When Russia responds, even if it's an accidental situation, then they threaten, they castigate, they lecture. Yeah, these countries with a fraction of Russia's landmass, a fraction of its resources, its military might, GDP growth, population. Same could be said of China and Iran and other emerging powers who seem to be the victims of this, I don't know, I would call it like a yappy dog syndrome. The small countries getting smaller every day, barking at bigger countries for simply being, well, bigger. Joining us now to talk about these matters is Patrick Henningsen. He is an award-winning journalist, a broadcaster, a geopolitical analyst, and the founder of the news site 21st Century Wire. Patrick, it is so great to have you on the show. How are you doing, my friend?
Very well, thank you. Great to be with you, Rick.
So let's start with, I think, what is the big news, and that is this development that has happened in Iran. It is starting to look more and more like Mr. Trump is very serious about trying to come up with this deal with Iran. It looks to me like they really are. It looks to me like he and some others in his administration really want to make this happen. It also looks to me like Israel wants to do everything possible to make sure it doesn't happen. Is that your assessment?
More or less, but I'm still not convinced at the sincerity of Washington on this, because they've flip-flopped so many times. And they've moved the goalposts so many times during negotiations. And let's not forget, Rick, they've also, you know, assassinated heads of state or targeted negotiators during negotiations,
yes.
Bombed the other side during negotiations, not just with Iran, but they've done this with Russia as well. And also Hassan Nasrallah, they lured Hezbollah leaders to meeting during peace negotiations, and of course they assassinate them all. And I could go on and on. The Hamas leadership is the same thing. So I'm very cautious about putting too much hope until it's just too, in my opinion, too early. A memorandum of understanding is nothing more than an agreement to a roadmap, which is 24 months in length, and there's a lot of pitfalls along the way there. And certainly Israel has plenty of opportunities to derail negotiations in many different ways, which they have done throughout the last 40 or 50 years. They're experts at coming in and sabotaging. The Oslo Accords, perfect example. That was a ruse that lasted 12 years. And look where it ended up, much worse than where it started. So, I have massive skepticism with regards to this. It's not just that, Rick. I'll say that I don't think the Trump administration's capable of negotiating a binding agreement or being yes. honoring the agreement. The United States and this administration, they don't have the personnel. They don't have a framework. They keep talking about deals. And there's no such thing as a deal in international law or in international relations. Really, there are agreements, there are accords, and there are treaties, none of which I think this administration's capable of doing. Plus, you're not dealing with just the United States and Iran. You've got this other entity behind the United States, or that's, under the cloak of the coat of the blazer of Trump, which is the state of Israel. And they reserve the right to do anything in their own interests, even if it's against the U.S. interest. So that's a real fundamental problem that maybe exist in other international conflicts, but this is quite unique, which makes it very difficult to see a solution.
Yeah, maybe I'm just trying to be hopeful, because it certainly would be a great thing for the world if this thing could end. But, you're absolutely right. And I kind of thought the same thing for a little while when I was interviewing Iranian officials and when I was in Iran talking to Arachi and some of these other folks. I always got a sense that they're very optimistic and very fair and very hopeful. More than we are, unfortunately, and I speak as an American. And I've asked myself this, and you just made me think about this while I was listening to your answer. I asked myself, if I were an Iranian, why would I trust these people who assassinated Soleimani, who killed their religious icon, who killed their family, who killed the people they were negotiating with, who killed a bunch of girls in a school and double-tapped them? It would be hard for me to take these people seriously. And, that's where it's hard to argue with your position, Patrick.
Well, I think from the Iranian perspective, they have learned from Russia. And Russia has, I don't believe personally that Russia, the higher up echelon of Russia, has no expectations that Washington and the Trump administration are agreement capable, nor the Biden administration for that matter, but even more so with the Trump administration sending fake envoys to Moscow that have no portfolio, Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner. It's not serious from a Russian perspective. So I think Russia basically recognized this and said, instead of doing diplomacy with the U.S., we're going to manage Trump We're going to manage the Trump administration, and we'll keep them managed and leave the door open for serious negotiations, which they don't really believe are going to happen, but they'll still leave the door open. And then they'll basically concentrate on what they need to do to secure their national security interests on the ground. Specifically, we're talking about Ukraine, but, you know, the whole line of contact there, as you pointed out in your previous segment. And I think the Iranians have adopted the same strategy with the U.S., is they just have to manage the erraticism, the chaotic nature of the Trump administration, the fact that you're dealing with low skill, very sort of short-term minded people who confuse tactics with strategy, and a lot of self-aggrandizement in Washington. And Iran has priced this in. They priced it in. That's why they're confident, because they know geostrategically, they also know they're on the right side of international law. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, that means the international system will bend in their favor, because, Rick, Iran has established itself as a normative power. And normative powers can enforce policy, human rights, ethical, moral issues, and other countries that can't do that. And the U.S. and other superpowers are also at times normative powers. The U.S. not so much now, but they have acted that way in the previous iteration of their governments. But to be a superpower, you have to have hard power to enforce those norms, that rule set based on a moral red line. Iran has done just that in the last few weeks. That means they've moved up to the upper echelon. Yeah. And no one else in the region has done that. Turkey has a bigger army, a bigger air force, a more powerful military on paper, aside from missiles. But Turkey is not a normative power in the region because they're tethered to NATO. Therefore, they have to kowtow to the United States. Iran is now the superpower of the region, and they're on the level of a global superpower, but not top tier. And that, to me, is a massive transformation in the grand chessboard, if you think about it. This is read right out of Zbigniew Brzezinski's predictions or fears, I would say, in the books that he wrote in the late 90s.
And it's also important to note, I think, and by the way, kudos to you for that explanation. You're so good at putting these things in such a cogent way so that we can understand it. But I was thinking, as you were just saying that the reason Iran has achieved the things that you just gave them props for is in many ways as much strategic as it is in terms of military prowess as it is moral. Because if you think about it, Patrick, the rest of the world bitched and complained about what was going on in Gaza. And the rest in the world has complained about Israel attacking Beirut and hitting churches, Catholics, Christians, you know. But there's only one country who's actually put their might where their words are, and that's Iran. Iran has said, no, we will not allow this, and we will not assign an accord that saves our butt if Beirut and the Palestinians are not included in it. That's a hell of a thing, isn't it?
Yeah, but only a normative power or a regional superpower can pull off that type of move. And Iran has done that. And, you know, they've really put the United States and Israel in a bind by including Lebanon into the package of any ceasefire or deal. Effectively, they created pressure between the U.S. and Israel. This is kind of a judo move. They're punching way above their weight, but because they have a strategy that makes sense for the region. But again, it's a moral red line. And, you know, if they stick to their principles, if Iran doesn't budge on these issues now, and then you see other countries will come to blame Israel and maybe support Lebanon. And a lot of European countries have good connections with Lebanon, but reticent because of the chaos internally in Lebanon and the sectarian divisions and Hezbollah and so forth, all those internal arguments, are now feel more free to come and maybe sanction Israel and get involved in that conversation. And it's because of what Iran has done. Iran has created that sort of pillar in the middle. That stability can be built off of, but only if they are steadfast. They cannot waver from their moral positions. And you know, the other reason they've done this, Rick, as well, it's because if they don't, Israel will use civilians in Lebanon and Gaza as leverage against the Iranians. And they've done exactly that. What happened when Iran retaliated with missiles into northern Israel? Immediately, Israel cut off aid to Gaza to punish the Palestinians. So they've already proven that they're going to use civilians. So that's why Iran has done this. And to me, it makes perfect sense. And it sends a signal to the international community that this is a serious country that has everyone's interest. Everyone's interest at mind. They want to save lives in Lebanon as much as their own citizens. And that, to me, you know, that takes that's not a country that's small-minded, that's only concerned about their own security. No, but they realize Lebanese security is their security.
They're doing what I wish in many ways that my country would do. But you mentioned Israel, so let me play something for you. This is Jonathan Conricus, and he's talking about how he seems to, and listen, I'm going to take some umbrage on this because I'm American, right? He seems to be criticizing the United States for not doing enough. He seems to say, listen to what he says when he gets to the end of this grab here. You'll hear him almost sound like he's saying the United States is weak and is giving up and hasn't done enough, and they're not good and powerful and courageous like the Israelis are. Here's the soundbite. Let's listen to it together.
The war was a good thing to do, but what I think is a problem here is the finishing accord and what appears to have been an urgency and a desire, an American desire and almost desperation to make a deal and stop fighting. And I think that the Iranians have a good nose for weakness. Whenever they sense weakness, they usually are good at exploiting it into their own for their own advantage. And I think in this sense, they understood that the Americans, unlike Israel, are too sensitive when it comes to fighting and when it comes to actually paying the price of fighting.
We've given them $34 billion a year. We fought seven countries in wars. American soldiers and troops have died for them. And this guy is on with Mario, who you were on with just, I think, a week ago as well, telling him that America's weak and doesn't do enough for Israel. My God, I don't know. What's your take on that?
First, I haven't been on Mario's podcast yet. So,
That's funny. I was watching you the other day. It must have been on another podcast.
It was on another one. Although Mario's asked me to come on, so we'll see. Maybe that will happen.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
But Jonathan Conricus, you have to know he's a propagandist for the Israeli government. That's his job. That's literally his job title. So you understand that. But he's saying the war is good. The war was good, but, you know, the U.S. hasn't finished the job. This war has been an abject disaster on every level for Israel, for the United States, for Iran, for all of the Gulf states. I mean, what planet is this guy on? It's just incredible. But, you know, to say that, it's so funny, you know, it's so quick to basically dump on the United States and, you know, say that Trump is just, you know, throwing them under the bus. It's like a trophy wife that suddenly is ready to leave her husband because he's gotten into financial trouble for the first time. Mm. I mean, talk about an ungrateful recipient of the blood and treasure of the United States of America. It's just mind-boggling. The Israeli dialogue, and this is very common, by the way. This is Jonathan's echoing a set of talking points that have been distributed by IPAC, you know, to all the sort of various operatives and media in Washington, and they're all basically singing in a chorus right now. It's pretty incredible.
I wonder if what they're most concerned about is that they've lost they've obviously lost the moral high ground. They lost that a long time ago. But I think there was still some Persian Gulf countries who were sticking it out and were thinking, well, maybe we could still have a good relationship with Israel and the United States, almost a dominion type of relationship with them at the expense of all of our other relationships with China and Russia and, you know, whoever the hell else. But I bet you those countries now, and at least some of my sources in those countries, have told me that they're rethinking this. And the fact that the Saudis were involved in these negotiations in Pakistan, I think is somewhat telling as well. What do you think?
Look, the Gulf states have to make really important decision for their existential future. I mean, these are not real natural countries. This is an artifact of the British Empire, basically. Yeah. You know, and they were drawn for effectively British interests. And then that baton was handed over to the United States as a sort of, you know, steward, or if you will, colonial manager of the region, to defend the petrodollar, to prop up the U.S. dollar using the petrodollar. And then now that shifted from the petrodollar to providing a security perimeter for the state of Israel. That is the number one priority of every single U.S. base in the region. So all of these Gulf states realizing that basically that, you know, the U.S. is running a protection racket, and they're very happy to suck as much money out of these Gulf states to buy weapons or pad Jared Kushner's Affinity Investment Fund or whatever, get investment on AI in the U.S. or buy shopping malls, you know, you name it. But now they're like looking at this and saying, we need to make a decision. Our relationship with Iran is going to affect our future because everything is moving east. Everything, the global capital is migrating eastward, not westward. All you have is problems in the West. Problems politically, economically, geopolitically. Eastward is where the safe landing pad for capital is in Shanghai right now. So all of these Gulf states need to think seriously about this. If you tether your future to the United States, you may be less prosperous. You may not exist as a country in 10 years, and you have a whole world of problems regionally. So, I mean, Qatar, I think, has recognized this very quickly. And so is Saudi Arabia, obviously has to play very carefully because they're all very exposed, Rick, to the U.S. dollar because a lot of them have their money in New York, basically. I mean, look, Iraq is completely over a barrel. Their sovereign wealth funds practically administered in New York City. So if they make a wrong move, they could easily be sanctioned, and then you've got a real problem. So, and that was set up after the Iraq war. The U.S. needed to keep their thumb on Iraq, because you know how important strategically Iraq is in using their airspace to attack Iran. So you can kind of see the geopolitical picture there. But forget about Kuwait and Bahrain. They're kind of they're U.S. colonies, basically. And the United Arab Emirates is also in a bind because they went to full normalization with Israel. And also they're very Americanized financially, politically and commercially. So they've got some problems, although for them, it's a big problem if they are going to butt heads with Iran. That could be a major blow to the UAE. It's already an economic blow, what's happened already. A lot of people have capital and businesses, U.S. brands have left the UAE as a result of what's happened recently. So, you know, this is a big moment for the GCC. The Gulf Cooperation Council, not what J.D. Vance has been calling it this week, which is the Gulf Coast Coalition. He's been saying this on interviews. And I'm thinking, Rick, the Gulf Coast, isn't that Texas, Mexico, Costa Rica?
That's where I grew up.
What is the vice president talking about? I want to give him a geography lesson.
You know, a country that, as I was listening to you, I was thinking there's a country that fascinates the hell out of me, and that's Oman. Because geographically, if you look at it, it's situated right there at the mouth of the Strait of Hormuz. And I can see them and think this is already maybe happening, where they can get together with Iran and do a deal and say, hey, let's share in the profits of all the shipping that is taking place, coming into and out of this place. And let's just group up. And they could maybe even, Iran could even extend that to a certain extent to the UAE and start empowering these countries to have a reason to move away from the West and to join the Irans and the Chinas and the Russias, for example, right?
Well, you know, Oman and Iran, by international law, they basically own the Strait of Hormuz because there is no international water. Their territorial waters meet in the Strait of Hormuz. So there is no international waterway in the Strait of Hormuz. That's both those countries' territorial waters. So it makes sense that they are joint managing that waterway and that they have a partnership. Certainly can be mutually beneficial, but Oman has a history of independence in the region. It's a very unique country. It's managed differently than other Arab countries. Also have a different characterization of the type of Islam that's practiced there, that's dominant in that country, slightly different. So there's a lot of unique aspects to it. They've always been very friendly with the British. traditionally the Omanis, and British military have used Oman's territory for exercise. I believe they may even have some military facilities there still, albeit small ones. But so they are very important, and they've acted as a mediator or as a middleman very wisely to help facilitate positive outcomes in the region. And they've been very resolute in that role, and that's impressive. And I think they have the respect of a lot of countries in the region because of their very careful, calculated diplomacy there. So, but at the end of the day, the U.S. is not a signatory to the U.N. Convention of the Law of the Seas of 1982. They're not. And neither is Iran. So there's really no argument there, like Marco Rubio has been trying to make, that this is an international waterway. How dare they? Well, why didn't you? You don't even sign the U.N. Convention of the Law of the Seas. So what are you talking about? You're just blowing hot air at this point.
No, they have a right to charge. They have a right to put on maintenance fees. They have a right to all of these things. And they never wanted to do it. It's almost like they've been forced into this position. Yeah, I think you're right. I think Oman may be one of the countries that comes out the best of this whole thing. Let's switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about the situation that happened today. I think we've got some pictures that we can show our viewers. This is a bus that was traveling between Belarus and Russia. It wasn't in Ukraine, and it was hit by a drone. And there were kids. It was a soccer team, a bunch of kids who were going to go play in a tournament in Russia. I mean, anywhere else, if any other country had done this, there would be screaming headlines in the New York Times calling this a horrible terrorist attack, and yet barely getting a whimper or a mess or any kind of stories on this. And it's not the first case. I see this happen all the time. I just covered it in Lugansk not long ago when I flew there to see what happened with those kids in the dormitory. Same thing. That was a bloody mess as well. It's kind of a double standard, isn't it?
It's worse than a double standard, Rick. There's kind of an institutionalized, I don't want to say racism. It's a type of a racism, but it's got a geopolitical frame to it, whereby you can't, there's no need to have any sympathy against any ethnic Russians. And, this has actually been baked into Europe. In the West for, many, many hundreds of years. There's always been this anti-Slavic, anti-Russian. The British have carried that anti-Russian torch, for 300 plus years. And I think there's just some kind of a legacy issue there they've tapped into. And, during the Cold War, Russia and the Soviet Union were demonized because of communism. So the framework for that kind of institutional hate was already there, and then it was switched off temporarily in the 90s, but they've just switched it back on again and poured in the new narrative in there, and it fits perfectly. And it's just, to me, I can't really believe it, and it's why it's really hard to look at Western political discourse and mainstream media and to look at how they treat different people around the world with different levels of humanity. And Arabs are so far down on that sort of scale of Western rating of personhood. It's just unbelievable. And of course, Israelis are right at the top or the pinnacle of that. You must have ultimate outrage and concern for one dead Israeli, but thousands of dead Arabs or Russians. It's a footnote. It's an afterthought. And the subtext of that, Rich, is, well, they deserve it. Because they haven't overthrown their leader. We do this to every single regime change target country. We blame the population for not rising up and overthrowing the government. And in a way, the subtext is, well, you kind of deserve it. You should have overthrown your evil dictator. So then, therefore, you're just collateral damage. And I'm talking about the psychology of the Western mind in terms of propaganda. And that's how it's constructed. And most people don't want to admit that. They don't want to talk about it. But that's actually the cold truth of it.
Yeah, listen, I think in many ways, the countries you and I and other Westerners hail from are as much...
I'm American. I'm born and raised in America, Rick.
So here's my argument to you, Patrick. I think we live in a dictatorship. Just because we don't have a dictator and we change the figurehead every 4 years doesn't mean the system ever changes. The system is as much a dictatorship as anything I see in Belarus or China or Russia or anywhere else. In fact, I'd say it's worse.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's so funny, Rick, that you hear critics of Iran saying, well, look, only 20% of the population support the regime in Tehran. And I'm thinking, well, what metric are you measuring that? Because let's go poll in the United States. How many Americans support the current Trump administration? We're looking at the polls right now, and it's a little bit over 20%, but you know, just about. So we talk about this like there should be some broad consensus of support, when in our countries, look at those leaders at the G7, Rick. What's Emmanuel Macron polling at?
12.
20, 18%.
12. Mertz was, right, 15.
All sub-20s, yeah. Starmer, Mertz, Macron, all of them. Trump is at his absolute low point in popularity. So who are we to talk about, you know, consensus? And then they'll say, well, the 60% of the Iranian population are indecisive, or they're sort of in between. And well, how much of the American population is indecisive that are not going to rise up and overthrow the government? That's what, 70% of the U.S. population are unhappy with government? The polling's clear on this. So, you know, we have no right to be judging countries, especially countries that have been under our sanctions for 47 years, or in the case of Russia, you know, for the last 10 or 12, 15 years. Yeah. The damage that has done to the country, economically, socially, politically, it's hit their institutions. It's made them unable to sort of manage basic civil functions and services in the country. And then there's, of course, people unhappy with that. And then we say, oh, they're mismanaging their economy. They do this to Syria, Venezuela. Yeah. They've done it to every single country. This is the game that's played in the West. And it is used to justify what we've just witnessed in the last 3.5 months, which is a full-blown war. And then blaming the, quote, regime. And then making up stories about 40,000 protesters that were killed. Using that as the moral underlay.
Yeah, it's not true.
To justify the military action.
I was there. I covered it. I was there the week before the bombing started, and I checked, and yeah, the government made a lot of mistakes, and a lot of people in Iran hated the government at the time, mostly for economic reasons, but there were not 40,000 people killed.
I was there. You came 2 days after I left Tehran, Rick. We just missed each other by 40 hours.
Could have had some good coffee. Maybe we end with this, and based on what you and I have been talking about, do you think historians will look back at this failed war in Iran on the part of the West, particularly the United States and Israel, and say that it was the hitch point in the turn, or maybe the beginning of the end, if you will, for the American Western hegemony, and the beginning of the empowerment of countries like Iran, China, Russia, et cetera? Will they?
I think so. I hope we survive to get that much distance in our rearview mirror to be able to say that, Rick. But if we do survive this administration and you know whatever potential turmoil is coming down the road, I think this will be exactly that line, that inflection point in history. It will definitely be in the history books, and it'll be a classic Faustian tale where, you know, the hubris of the United States and this, and wanting to, you know, do the ultimate show of strength, you know, a flailing, dying, a punch drunk former empire in the ring, you know, just, it's that final fight of that former prize fighter that just one fight too many, and it all goes down, and it's an absolute tragedy. So at their, what they think is at their absolute strength by showing that, but by brutalizing a weaker opponent, they've then exposed themselves for what their true nature is. And you're seeing the mask come off on so many levels with just the corruption, the arrogance, the hubris. And people are disgusted by it worldwide. And Trump, in a way, has really revealed the true nature of empire. And it's fast-tracked the demise of that very empire. And that's the real story. That will be, I mean, this is legendary. It's biblical, in fact. And it will be seen as that in the future, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. Be careful what you wish for. It didn't turn out that way. Patrick, thank you so much. You are just an excellent thinker. I love the way you, not only the way you think, but the way you explain your thoughts so that they're so cogent and easy to understand and palatable, right? Thank you, my friend. I really enjoy this conversation. Let's do it again.
Yeah, thank you very much for the invite, Rick.
So that's it for us. I do want to do this. You can find our shows on X, on Spotify, on YouTube, on BitChute. And I want you to know that conversations like this are important. This is where you get a free thinking sort of ideas about what's actually happening in the world in different theaters, for example. And what I think is almost a sense of fairness, or at least of equal sighting in terms of what's really happening, and not just a Western hegemonic perspective all the time. And that's all we try to do. It's not to say one side is right or one side is wrong. It's about all sides at times are right or wrong, but it needs to be explained. I'm so glad we had Patrick on, and I'm so glad that you're there. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes, and we'll be looking for you next time.